Welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, bringing the tales and stories of the ancient Celts to your fireside. Episode SP39, Druid Special Number 1. Hello, welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show. I'm Gary.
And I'm Ruth. Before we start, we'd like to say a big thank you for downloading this Druid special. We really hope you enjoy it.
We do. As you know, we try to bring you as much information about the ancient Celts, their ancestors, and their descendants as we can. And this show is the first part of a fantastic interview with the head of a modern Druid order.
But before we start, how can you contact us? Well,
you can chat to us using Twitter or on Facebook, or you can send us some feedback by emailing us at garyandruth@celticmythpodshow.com. You could also leave us some voice feedback by using the grey widget on the right-hand side of our website pages.
So anyway, what's this show all about then?
Well, we got to talk to Philip Shalcrass, also known as Greywolf, who is the head of the British Druid Order, the BDO, and this show is the first half of that interview. You'll be able to hear the second half in our next show.
Ooh, exciting. It was a super interview as well, wasn't it?
It was. Before we start, have we got any news and views?
Went to the Anderida Fest earlier this year, February 2014.
Yes, I do. Yes, we saw some great lectures, met some super people, heard some great music and had a wonderful time.
Well, we did, actually. It was fabulous.
It was.
But if you're not already subscribed to Druidcast, and if you're not, why not? Have a listen to episode 84.
Oh, yes. The host, Dave the Bard, has let us listen to the amazing talk given by Professor Roland Rotherham again. The professor talked about sacred wells and their connection to severed heads. Sacred wells and the beheading game, he calls it. Wonderful, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was fascinating. Go and have a listen. The details are in the show notes. You'll really enjoy it. Rowley is a fun and fascinating lecturer. Definitely worth a listen.
Now, talking of Dave, should we start this show off with one of his classic tracks?
Excellent idea. Which one did you think would start our show off on the right note?
Well, let's have a listen to one of the powerful songs from his first album, Herne's Apprentice, called The Fithfath Song.
Shall go as a wren in spring, with sorrow and sighing on silent wing. And I shall go in Our Lady's name, I till I come home again. Then we shall follow as falcons gray, and hunt me cruelly for a prey, and we shall go search around. With sorrow and sighing and mickle doubt.
Was the enchanting sound of Dave the Bard with the Fifth Fast song from his album Herne's Apprentice.
That was definitely a magical song.
Yes, great, wasn't it? Now let's move on to the first part of our interview with Philip Shawcross, the head of the British Druid Order.
Well, we were lucky enough to meet him and his son Joe on a stormy night in the little smuggler's town of Rye. His other son, Mike, Superchap, couldn't make the interview, but did take the photograph that you can find in the show notes.
Excellent. So let's get on with it, shall we? Have a listen to our interview with Philip Shawcross, a.k.a. Greywolf.
Hi, we're here today with Philip Shawcross, also known as Greywolf, head of the British Druid Order, and his amazing son, Joe. Hi, Joe. Hi, Philip.
Hello. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good, thank you. How's yourself?
All right.
And Ruth is at the other end of the table.
Hi, folks.
Yep, there's the proof. And they've come to talk about lots of things, hopefully. The first question we'd like to ask you is about the British Druid Order. How did you come to start it? What's it all about? How did it start?
Depends how you look at start, really. I mean, these days, I think it probably started when I was about 5 years old and started having really strange dreams and peculiar waking visions.
Oh, right.
And needed a way of working out what they meant.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it took me about 15 years. And then I read Robert Graves' The White Goddess in 1974 and realised that what I'd been all these years and the possible answer to my questions was I was a druid.
Because The White Goddess is an incredible book, isn't it?
It's an amazing book. A lot of people don't like it because of its historical inaccuracies, but that was never the idea. It's about poetry.
You tend to forget that the man was a poet. And absolutely. He wrote two books on Greek myths as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
Astounding guy.
Which have also been criticised for inaccuracies, but, you know, they're still kind of the nearest you've got to a standard reference work that includes all of them. So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And the guy was a poet. A really good one, too.
Yes. So, from your own discovery of feeling that you were a druid, what inspired you to start a druid order?
That's quite a long leap, isn't it, really? From
Really, it was not being able to find one that already existed that I wanted to join, really.
Okay.
I mean, this was 1974, right? So Ross Nichols, who'd founded the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids in 1964.
Right, we've heard of those, haven't we?
Uh-huh.
Yep.
If I'd have known that Obod was around when Ross was still alive and in business, I would very probably have joined.
Right.
From what I subsequently found out about them, very cool. Unfortunately, I didn't find Ross in that first year from 1964 until Ross died in 1975. And so, you know, the only other Druid order that was around was the Ancient Druid Order, who were the ones who turned up at Stonehenge every summer solstice.
Oh, in the white robes and the booties and things.
Yeah, and that appeared to be the only time of year they ever did anything anywhere, because it was the only time of year anyone ever saw them.
Yeah.
They would be on the front page of the, you know, Daily Telegraph or whatever. Nice photograph of them all in their white robes watching the sunset at Stonehenge. And then they seemed to just melt away for the rest of the year. So, who knew how to find them? And, well, in any case, looking at those photos, you could see they were all wearing nice business suits under their white robes, and they just...
appeal, does it? It's not...
Given my hippie youth, they just didn't look like my kind of druids, really.
You were a hippie, were you?
Yeah, certainly was.
I don't know why you're using the past tense.
Ah, is that true, Joe?
No, I was just in time. I was 14 in that great year, 1967.
So, how did you start a druid order without knowing what one did? If you didn't have any work to get, where did you get your ideas how to set it up? Because Obod, as you say, Obod wasn't within your frame of reference. Where did you get your information from?
This was the immediate problem. Having read The White Goddess and having thought, oh, wow, I think I'm probably a druid. I mean, one of the things that drew me to the idea of being a druid is that the old stories of Britain and Ireland, specifically Britain, it's the Mabinogion that I liked. That was the one that got to me. Mm-hmm. It's the Mabinogi and the story of Taliesin and the poetry of Taliesin. And they immediately seemed to me to be religious texts.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that the old translations of them made them sound like they were straight out of the King James Bible.
It helped.
You got the impression that that's what they were. Mm-hmm. They were religious texts. But, unlike the Bible, they were not religious texts that referenced camels and palm trees. Mm-hmm. They were religious texts that referenced bulls, stags, the kind of mountains that, you know, I knew existed in the land where I lived, the kind of trees that were around where I lived. They related to the land that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
That, for me, was a really big appeal.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I did the 60s thing of looking east for inspiration, you know, like Zen Buddhism and Hinduism and like everybody was in the 60s, you know. And they're great. Nothing against them at all. But again, they didn't quite ring true because they had a different cultural origin. They had a different origin of land.
Whereas you felt that the Mabinogi had a relationship with that, with the Mabinogi and the stories it was telling.
Yeah. Well, if you read stories and they take place in an environment that you know, in the country where you live, there's automatically, as far as I was concerned at least, an instant link there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And an instant frame of reference, just a different level of understanding.
Mm.
So, I mean, that was my starting point. And then, you know, obviously you think, okay, I'm a druid. Now what?
Yeah. Where do you go from here?
Well, I have to admit, you know, the first thing was, like, everybody knows druids wear white robes, right? That's just, it's in the consciousness. So the first thing I did to make myself into a druid was I bought a white robe.
Excellent.
So now, how often did you have to wash it?
Well, yeah, reasonably often. I went against the grain of tabloid reporting for what hippies were supposed to be like. Bathing and washing clothing quite regularly.
Glad to hear it, old chap.
So did you make this yourself or did you actually go and buy one?
Yeah, I went out to London and I went to Kensington Market and I bought my white robe from Kensington Market.
Excellent.
And I bought a black cloak at the same time. Uh-huh. And so,
because it's cool.
Bear in mind I had sort of really long hair and quite a long beard at the time, and so, you know, I'm wearing this like Moroccan white robe wandering around, long hair, beard, sandals, you know.
I see.
So the standard comment that I got was, who do you think you are then? Jesus.
Oh dear.
No, actually, I'm a druid.
I take it he doesn't dress like this at home now.
Not often.
not all the time.
And the rest of the time you don't need to tell us about.
But But, you know, it's like, not you know, that saying sort of walk a mile in a man's shoes, you know. Mm. So I figured I'd put on the robe and see what happened next. Because back in the mid-70s, you couldn't just go to your local bookstore and find, like, 16 different books on how to be a druid.
Yes.
There were none. Literally none.
You see, I remember you studying everything and anything you could get your hands on at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Anything relating to Celtic archaeology, to Celtic stories, just whatever you could find.
So you some kind of synthesis of all that lot did you bring together?
Looking for practical things that you could do as a druid.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, you know, there were no guidebooks, none whatsoever. So where'd you go? You go to the couple of books that there were around on witchcraft at the time.
Yeah.
Because they at least, you know, give you some guidelines as to how to cast circles and do, you know, basic kind of ritual stuff.
Yes.
Actually, before I got into Wicca, I did the whole Golden Dawn ritual magic thing.
Yes.
Which was kind of jumping in at the deep end a bit, really.
Yes.
I mean, as you know, the Golden Dawn system is the most complex magical system that anyone has ever created anywhere. I mean, it makes the Catholic Church look like, you know, the Boy Scouts. But, yeah, I sort of went through all that as well. And then, yeah, Wicca. I mean, a lot of Wicca sort of made a lot of sense to me. Particularly once I discovered that a lot of Wiccans were working with the Celtic deities that I'd already come to know through the myths and stories. So, yeah, I merged some of the... There was this lovely little coven that I joined in Hastings.
Oh, really?
Oh, dear. Yes, I say, you know, having, like, looked and failed for a few years to find a druid group, I was invited to join this Wiccan coven, and at that point I was still, as I say, looking for something operative that I could do as a druid. Because there were no clues anywhere as to what to do as a druid, I thought, well, yeah, okay, you know, witches do ritual stuff along kind of similar lines from what I could gather from reading. So, yeah, we'll sign up and join that one. And when I discovered that we were working with the goddess Ceridwen, it was a no-brainer after that, because I already discovered, you know, Ceridwen was
pretty cool.
the goddess, as far as I was concerned, at that point in my life. And she did the whole, you know, initiatory sequence in the story of Taliesin and the shape-shifting, and, you know, she had the cauldron and all the right attributes, as far as I was concerned. Because, the shape-shifting thing, I have to mention that as well, because... literally at the same time as reading The White Goddess, if I got bogged down with Robert Graves' prose in The White Goddess, which I did from time to time because he kept quoting things in Greek and Latin, I would switch to reading Mircea Eliade's Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy.
Ah.
And where that came in handy was because in Eliade's descriptions of how people get to be shamans in traditional cultures, a lot of it was saying, well, you know, shamans usually are weird kids, and usually they have weird visionary experiences when they're quite small, and they have repeating dreams, and they go out wandering around in the middle of the night and hang out with animals for preference to people, and basically just describing my childhood.
Yes.
Excellent.
So I kind of made the automatic conclusion, reading those two simultaneously, that Druidry had been the... native British equivalent of shamanism. So when I read the story of Taliesin and found that little Gwion, who becomes the great enlightened bard Taliesin, had the ability to shapeshift, and that he'd got that ability to shapeshift from drinking the three drops from the cauldron of inspiration, and that the goddess Ceridwen, who brewed the cauldron, could also shapeshift, and these are kind of obvious shamanic traits. I mean, the two just... so obviously
so
fell together.
That's where you link the two together.
Yeah.
We were going to ask that later on, weren't we?
That screwed that question.
So you said you had the answers before we knew the questions.
Yeah.
You were right.
So, just coming to now, because druids have kind of evolved, haven't they, since Obod started and you've started the BDO, and there's all these druid organisations all across the world now.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a a broad question, but what would you consider a modern druid to be today?
That is a very broad question, because you've still got the 18th century druid groups are still going, like the Welsh Gorsedd of Bards.
Yeah, these are the fraternal ones.
And they're
aren't
a cultural institution.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you've got groups like the Ancient Order of Druids, again founded in the 18th century, and they're pretty much a friendly society, kind of Masonic in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still going. So there's that whole side of Druidry. But over the last 30 years or so, the more recognisable public face of Druidry has been groups like the BDO, like OBOD.
Mm-hmm.
In
America, we've got the ADF and...
Yeah, ADF, yeah, who've been around for a heck of a long time now.
Yes, they have.
Ever since dear old Isaac.
Yeah, who was also called Philip, of course, his first name was
absolutely.
Because
yes.
You have to be called Philip to run a druid. Or
so we're finding, anyway.
Oh, dear. Yeah, sorry, where were we?
Modern druids, what the practical...
Oh, type. yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the kind of druidry that we've been developing with the BDO and that Philip Cargom's been developing with OBOD and that ADF have been developing more or less independently in the States. We have similar kind of roots because a lot of what we do has overlaps with and influence from Wicca. Because Ross Nichols, when he founded the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids in 1964, he was a friend of Gerald Gardner.
So we hear.
Father
yes,
Gordon Wicca.
That's right.
Mm.
So I had been in the Wiccan coven, which gradually mutated until it decided it was no longer going to be a coven. It was going to call itself a grove, which was an interesting choice of words, because at the time none of us knew that was what
druid groups,
OBOD groups, yeah, call themselves. But it just kind of came up, and we were the Grove of the Badger, and I still have fond memories of the Grove of the Badger.
It's an awesome name.
And I still have some of the handwritten book of some of the rituals from the Grove of the Badger as well.
Oh, amazing.
I proudly keep upon my shelves. We had this sort of influence from Wicca, which was the thing that started paganising druidry. Because a lot of the druid revivalists in the 18th century and onwards were, I mean, not just Christian, but Christian ministers.
Mm.
So there was a big thread running through, and some of the earlier antiquarians had said that druidry was monotheistic because it worshipped God as the sun. So it was supposed to be paving its way for the Abrahamic faiths to arrive,
Ooh.
For monotheism to arrive. But then with the kind of spiritual explosion that there was in the 60s, which a lot of us who set up druid groups later went through as well, so we had all of that, which involved people like John Michel, the Earth Mysteries movement,
yes.
Was all in there. So again, linking into the Earth as a spiritual entity. And then we had the influence from Wicca. And these things began a gradual paganising of druidry. And by the time you got to sort of early 80s, and particularly the middle 80s, there was a kind of another small explosion of people setting up new druid groups then. And groups that were very overtly pagan.
Yeah.
I'd considered myself a pagan since I read Thor comics when I was at school in the 60s. So, you know, being a pagan druid was pretty obvious for me because I was already a pagan.
Immortal
Jack Kirby.
Thor is indeed, yeah.
He is Marvel. It's Marvel's fault, I see.
Yeah, created by my favourite artist of all time, the great Jack Kirby.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Crazy.
Okay, so let's take a little break there and maybe have some music.
Yeah, that sounds a great idea. What did you have in mind?
I had this thought that as we were talking about trying to find some connection with the Ancient Ones in modern druidry, then it might be nice to hear Kellyanna's title track from her album, the ancient ones.
So let's have a listen to our friend Kellyana.
Hear a song of time gone by, the ancient ones are calling out, and they sing a song of old, and their words will carry us home, and their song carry us home. Hear a song of time gone by, the ancient ones are calling out, and they sing a song of old, and their song will carry us home. Hear a song,
the ancient ones
of time gone by,
they call you home.
The ancient ones,
they call you back,
are calling out
to the ancient ways,
and they say,
the ancient
song of old,
they call you home,
and their words,
they call you back,
will carry us home
to the ancient ways,
and their song,
they call you back,
will carry us home
to the ancient ways.
Hear a song,
remember now,
of time gone by,
the ancient ones.
The ancient ones,
remember now,
are calling out
the ancient ways,
and they say,
remember now,
a song of old,
the ancient ways,
and their words,
it's deep inside,
words will carry us home,
your memories,
and their song,
it's deep inside,
us home,
your memories.
Hear a song,
the ancient ones
of time gone by,
they call you home.
The ancient ones,
they call you back,
are calling out
to the ancient ways,
and they say,
the ancient ones,
a song of old,
they call you home.
And their words,
the ancient
words, will carry us home.
They call you home,
and their song,
the ancient ones,
will carry us home.
They call you home,
and their words,
to the ancient ways,
will carry us home.
They call you home,
and their song.
That was the amazing Kellyana with her track The Ancient Ones from the album of the same name.
Beautiful and powerful track, isn't it?
Oh, it is.
We're going to be seeing her and Dave the Bard do a gig together in August. So if you're near the south coast of the UK, it's going to be one not to be missed. And you can find the details in the show notes, can't they?
Absolutely. Now, let's go back to the interview.
Yes, let's.
So, Joe, growing up with your dad, founding the BDO, did you found it on your own or was it with anybody's help? Just as a quickie.
I think, well, yeah, it actually came about when I was at a festival in Cornwall.
Right.
Pop festival. It's really great. It was at Pole Gooth. Best I've ever been to. It was cracking. I ran into an old friend of mine down there. And when I say an old friend, he was about 78 at the time. And he was dancing wildly to a band who were on stage playing Irish jigs. And I hadn't seen him for years. And his name was, curiously, Philip.
Because they all are.
So why did you name...
There was a guy back in Hastings who was also called Philip, who'd expressed an interest in getting something together. So I saw old Philip at this festival in Polkwood.
Now, you are following this, folks, aren't you?
The world has been taken over by Philip.
And he said, what are you doing these days? And I said, well, you know, I was thinking of getting this druid group together, and would you like to be co-chief of it? Because we ought to have three Philips. And he said, oh, yes, that'd be great. What's it called? And I hadn't thought of a name at the time. And I thought, British Druid Order. And that was...
So there we are.
That was when the British Druid Order actually first came about, was in front of the stage with Irish jigs playing wildly in the background.
A superb setting. So the question was, Joe, with you growing up with your dad in this lunatic development of incredible hard work that he's done over the years...
Where there are hundreds of Philips.
Building the BDO up, when you have to be a member, be called Philip to join it... Where did that leave you? How did you feel? Did you want to take
Well, until I was 5 years old, I thought everybody in the world was called Philip. No. Honestly, the best answer I can give you at this juncture is theologically confused. I mean, as obviously growing up at home, I had the whole druidry thing, but most of the schools I've been to have been loosely sort of Christian, sort of C of E primary schools and things, because they were the ones that we could actually get to. And that's quite aside from the various druids, Wiccans, chaos mages, Zoroastrians, Buddhists, and everything else I've met since, sort of miscellaneous hippies, folkies, and weirdos.
Wow, sounds an amazing life,
doesn't it? I enjoy it, you know.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
So would you call yourself a druid now? Are you a member of BDO?
I don't know, sort of, I don't know if I'm officially a member.
Yes, you are.
There you go. You have it from the horse's mouth. Sorry, the wolf's mouth.
It's official now. Yeah, I mean, I get on with these people. Sort of still not entirely sure exactly what I would classify myself as.
So
would
it be fair to say you're still working out your own path?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's sort of bits and pieces of all kinds of things that I thought, yeah, that sounds reasonable, or I don't know about that.
That sounds a really healthy approach. a really healthy approach.
When I'm asked to classify, I tend to describe myself as sort of European neo-pagan, just...
Wow, that sounds complicated.
Yeah. Just to sound as pretentious as I humanly can, you know.
Yeah.
And to throw people off the scent.
Yes.
I get less accusations of... Sorry, fewer accusations of Satanism that way.
So let's just get it straight. Druidry's got nothing to do with Satanism, yeah?
Not as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. Off the table.
I have yet to meet a satanic druid.
Excellent. Sorted. That's all out the window.
That's
super.
It. You damn well know we're going to get an email from one now.
Sorry.
You were talking about neo-paganism. Can I go back to your dad and talking about modern druids, the neo-pagans, modern druids, kind of linking that idea together. Do you see any link between modern druids, whether they be neo-pagans or the fraternal type or the third type you mentioned, I've forgotten already, but never mind. Do you see any connection between those and the ancient Celtic druid?
Yeah, it depends what you mean by connection.
Any similarities? Any links?
Well, I mean, the cultural druids in Wales...
That was the third type I can remember, wasn't it?
Probably have the best claim to a direct link, because there's a bardic tradition, a tradition of reverence for poets, that's gone on in Wales, Ireland and Scotland. I mean, look at, you know, Robbie Burns, most famous Scot ever. Poet. So there's this sort of reverence for poets, and the reverence for poets was something that existed in, you know, Caesar's time and before, according to the Greek and Roman writers. Poets were part of the same cultural block that included druids. So you could make a tentative claim that there is a kind of direct line of succession, albeit a wobbly one. The kind of, for want of a better term, shamanic druidry that I've been trying to teach myself and trying to show to others in the British Druid Order for all these years has been described by my historian friend Ronald Hutton as possibly getting as close to what original druids were and did as it's possible to get.
Ah, fascinating.
At this remove. Because there's quite a widespread belief now in people like Miranda Althouse Green, who's probably the foremost authority on Celtic history and archaeology that we've got in Britain at the moment.
Yes.
She maintains that druids were the equivalent of shamans in Celtic culture back in the day. So by trying to make those direct spirit connections with the spirits of place, with the spirits of trees, animals, people, the world in general, storms, mountains, rivers, etc., etc., I feel, and you know, some archaeologists seem to be backing me up on this, although they might not if you ask them directly.
And how much are you paying them? So we've recently come across, like, you know, you're talking about these archaeological findings, and they're finding that, you know, they're finding various substances in the ashes left in tombs and all sorts of things that makes them think that they may have had a shamanic experience. Some of these are hallucinogens and etc. Do you think that...
There's also those things like burnt mounds, aren't there, that could be sweat lodges or something like that.
Yes.
You know, the structures where...
It's circumstantial because I can't prove anything.
Yes, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, the burnt mounds one, my friend Mark Graham of the Charmed Order of Druids took part in a reconstruction of a Bronze Age sweat lodge with a group of archaeologists. This took place on the outskirts of Birmingham a few years ago. Because they have several of those piles of burnt rocks up there. Mark had seen these, and he thought that the kind of striations on the surface and the kind of blackening that they'd got seemed to indicate to him that they'd been heated up and used in sweat lodges.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some archaeologists who agreed with him, some who vehemently disagreed and said that they were cooking sites or that they were used for brewing beer.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to do an experiment and use the same kind of rocks and use them in a sweat lodge and see how they came out of the sweat lodge and compare them to the ones on the Bronze Age mound. And that's exactly what they did. And they did a sweat lodge. Mark stripped off and went in, and the archaeologist stripped off and went in behind a discreet screen that had been set up because there were a lot of members of the public standing behind a little fence.
With cameras.
So, make clear for me, because I'm not totally sure on this, because my vision of a sweat lodge is something like a sauna. But what exactly is a sweat lodge? What is it supposed to do?
Well, kind of like a sauna, but smaller, tighter, enclosed, and pitch dark. The bender variety of sweat lodge is what we're talking about, which is the kind used by the Lakota and other plains tribes in the States.
Our American friends will probably know more about this than I do then.
Yeah.
So these are the ones made with wands and leaves and those?
Sort of long bits of willow or hazel or some other sort of bendy branch, and you cut them fresh and you make a low dome and you cover it. Used to be in hides, but these days people use heavy canvas.
And tarps.
You completely cover over the dome, leaving just a flap at the front to crawl in through. And once you're in, you close the flap, you're in pitch darkness. Most of the people I know who use them refer to this as the womb of Mother Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rocks are heated on a fire outside. You build a sort of pyramidal fire. The rocks are in the middle. You burn it for quite some time. It generates incredible heat. The stones are usually glowing at least yellow, if not white hot.
Good grief.
In the fire itself. You hoik them out on a shovel, shove them in through the flap of the door when it's opened up, and they go into a little hole in the middle of the lodge, and they sit there and glow red, and then you pour water on them. And because the domes are very low and kind of tight, and you're all sitting fairly close to the hole in the middle, they're small, so the steam that comes off generates incredible heat really, really quickly. And what I found with the first one that I did was you get kind of pushed to your physical, mental, emotional and spiritual limits. Granted, there were people who were in that one with me who had done lots of sweat lodges before who said it was the hottest one they'd ever been in their lives.
You don't do things by halves, do they?
But while we're on the subject of that sweat lodge, that was how I got to be called Grey Wolf.
Oh, really?
It was that first sweat lodge that I did.
Tell us what happened. Yeah.
Well, it was about the third lot of rocks that had come in, and another lot of water was ladled onto them, and I think it was the beginning of the second round, because in a lot of sweat lodges, because it gets so incredibly intensely hot, a lot of folks, they let you out after a round, which lasts, you know, about half an hour or whatever. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually leave this thing until the third round was over, and each of the rounds lasted, I don't know how long, but it must have been more than an hour, because we were in the thing all night. But anyway, the beginning of the second round, it was really intensely hot, and I was kind of thinking, am I going to pass out here? So I did what we'd been instructed before, which was you kind of stick your head right down on the ground and try and shove your nose up against where the canvas meets the ground and try and get a bit of cool air into your lungs. And I got a couple of gulps of comparatively cool air, sat up again. And at that time, the woman who was running the sweat lodge was calling to the animal guardians, spirit guardians of the four quarters. Mm-hmm. And she'd been trained in Lakota style. So she called Coyote at one of the quarters. And we were in a field in southern England. And I thought, hang on, we've never had Coyote in England. So what would our equivalent be? And now what I should have thought, because of the whole thing about Coyote being trickster, what I should have thought was Fox.
Yes.
Because the fox is the trickster in our native stories. What I actually thought was wolf. And as soon as the word wolf came into my mind, I saw this fully grown adult male wolf curled up in the pit in the middle of the lodge with the hot rocks inside his body.
Wow.
And after a while, he stood up and he kind of swung his head to one side, like, follow me. So my spirit then left my body and I followed the wolf out of the lodge. And this was the middle of summer and we were in this like grassy field. But when I got outside with the wolf in spirit, we were on the lower slopes of a snow-covered mountain. And he led me away through the snow. I followed in his tracks as best I could. It was actually really nice being out. It was so cool off of the lodge. It was beautiful. But we got up to the tree line, which was some distance away, and there was a path that ran off into the forest. And at the beginning of the path, the wolf turned round and kind of spoke to me mind to mind. And he said, now it's time for you to go back to your body, but next time we meet, I'll lead you into the forest. At which point I made my way back to my body in the sweat lodge. And because I'd cooled down out in the snow, I found it a real doddle to get through the rest of the sweat lodge. But I knew that having had this really powerful vision of this wolf, you know, I knew that I had to find something to connect me with wolf. But I was like 40 years old at the time, and I'd never, ever in my entire life seen hide nor hair, tooth nor claw of a wolf ever anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, you know, how's that going to work? So, because like 8 days later, right, I'm back from this druid camp where I'd done the sweat lodge, and a friend of mine phones me up and says, we're having a garage sale at my parents' house. Do you want to come over? So go over to the garage sale. Of course, first thing I see is this huge pelt lying on top of a water tank. And I looked at it and thought,
okay, that's fine.
That's wolf. No, come on, that can't be wolf. No, really, that cannot be wolf. So I said to my friend, the skin, the pelt, what's that? And he said, I think that's wolf. All right, okay. And it had been in his parents' attic. It had been in the house when they bought it in 1947.
Oh, my goodness.
And from then up until 94. Yeah, when I had this vision. So from 1947 to 1994, he'd been in this attic. And the day I had the vision in the sweat lodge was the day he went up into the loft, found it and brought it down. And it's the first thing I see when I get there.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So I took this thing. It was made out of the pelts of six wolves sewn together. And I started wearing it as a cloak.
Mm-hmm.
And also I got this wolf name that kind of came to me not long after the lodge, which was Wolf Walks with Fire. The reason being that the wolf, as he got up and walked out, kind of had these still hot glowing rocks inside his body,
mm-hmm.
hence Wolf Walks with Fire. But that got shortened as I got greyer.
Yeah, don't we all?
Yeah, yeah. So now Grey Wolf. And, yeah. Oh, yeah, and there was the occasion when Joe was little. I was standing doing the washing up at the sink in the kitchen, and Joe came over to me and said, "Daddy, are you Wolf Who Washes Up?"
Oh, that is so an excellent name, Joe.
I adopted that for a while as well.
Wolf Who Washes Up.
Is this ever something you've fancied trying, Joe, at Sweat Lodge?
Yeah, I don't know. I've thought about it.
I'd love to go, but I don't think my health would be up to it.
Yeah, yeah, no, like I say, I worry about things that get quite that intense.
I think you're right.
That's understandable. Yeah, yeah, it's a natural
it's
fear,
daunting,
isn't it? Yeah, no, that's
yes.
That's
I think it is something I'd like to try at some point.
But when you're ready,
when I next get the opportunity, is anybody's guess.
Absolutely,
it's not something that comes along particularly frequently.
Absolutely,
and it sounds fabulous. It's something that appeals to me. I think next week. No, it's a brilliant experience. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Well, that was absolutely amazing, riveting and fascinating stuff.
It certainly was. Can't wait for you to hear the second half of the interview now.
Well, you will in the next show. But just to get you all in the mood, we know that Philip is a bard. So let's listen to a track from his album, The Sign of the Rose. This track was written after he'd had a meeting with the Saxon god Woden on a North Wiltshire burial mound, and is a call to the old Saxon gods of Britain.
Yes, you can just imagine the scene, can't you?
So let's hear Philip Shalcrass with his Song at Wodensburg.
She comes to me from near and far. She shines beyond the evening star. She comes as pale twilight fades from gold to shades of night, brightening the jewel that we are, the crimson jewel that we are. She comes as silent as the moon, shines on the dolmen stones unhewn, as soft as raven's cry when the god plucked out his eye, to gain the draught of wisdom's bloom, the draught that pierced the veils of doom. Through honeyed mead she gives the gift of sacred song, drawn from the darkened land of sleep. Brave heart and best of bards need to love her deep and long, and drain her draught both long and deep. Her honeyed draught both long and deep. On falcon wings she rises high, borne on the billows of the sky, a heart from elder times bringing riddles, runes and rhymes, one who yields to her sweet sigh, who bends before her tender sigh. Through honeyed mead she gives the gift of sacred song, born from the darkened land of sleep. Brave heart and best of bards needs a lover deep and long, and drain a draught long and deep, her honeyed draught both long and deep. She comes to me from near and far, to me from near and far. She comes to me from near and far.
That was great, wasn't it? The song At Wodensburg from his album A Sign of the Rose. Thank you, Philip, for letting us play it.
Superb. Now then.
What?
Have we got new listener feedback?
Actually, yes, we have.
Oh, cool.
We've got a lovely message from our friend Sean McDye from Florida. And it's so lovely to finally hear your voice, Sean.
Oh, super. Go on, play it then.
Oh, okay then.
Hi, Ruthie and Gary. This is Sean McDye from Orlando, Florida in the U.S. I just wanted to drop you two a message and let you know how much we all appreciate the work you do on the pod show and on your site and in the pages and group on Facebook. For those of us interested in Celtic mythology, the resources and information you provide are just awesome and unparalleled. So thank you, and blessings of the gods of our ancestors and blessings of the she to you. And I hope you two have a great summer. Thanks. Bye.
Sean, that was so kind of you to say such generous things.
It was. Yes, thanks for your lovely message. How many years has it been since we started chatting on Facebook? Actually, I think we started chatting to you on our forums before that as well.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Must be
at least 4 or 5 years, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Sean, thank you so much. It really does mean an awful lot that you found so much of use to you in what we do.
And so much pleasure as well. Thank you again, Sean. And you have a lovely summer too. We're just still waiting for ours to appear, but hopefully it'll be here soon.
She's kidding. Spring is beautiful here.
I know. But in Florida, it's summer all the time.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it just never gets below about 58 degrees. Anyway, now I think it's time we bowed our way out of this show with the last piece of music.
Okay, good idea. So what did you have in mind?
Well, now that springtime is truly on us and the autumn leaves are beginning to dance down under, we can see the wheel of the year turning in all its glory. So have a listen to Blanche Rowan and Mike Golston with their brilliant track, The Four Seasons, from their new album, The Dance Goes On.
Blow through the woods in springtime, roots drink deep from the wakened earth. Young leaves shine in the quickening sunlight, dance the song of the new year's birth. The dance goes on and is never ending, the circle turns and the singer sings. The year turns round, but the wood in springtime does not care what the winter brings. The dance goes on and is never ending, the circle turns and the singer sings. Year turns round, but the wood in springtime does not care what the winter brings. When the leaves are long in the days of summer and the light drifts through them cool and green, the great trees stir in their dreaming sleep and sing slow tales of the years they've seen. The dance goes on and is never ending, the circle turns and the tale unfolds. The year turns on, but the wood in summer
has no thought for the winter's cold. The dance goes on and is never ending. The circle turns and the tale unfolds. The year turns on, but the wood in summer has no thought for the winter's cold. Hazel and elderberry hang heavy and ripe in the shortening days. Bright as a banner, the autumn leaves burn red in the old sun's dying rays. The dance goes on and is never ending. The circle turns and returns again. The year burns on and the wood in autumn gathers itself for the winter's pain. The dance goes on and is never ending. The circle turns and returns again. The year burns on and the wood in autumn gathers itself for the winter's pain. When winter bites and the leaves have fallen, through the hawthorn cold winds run, through dwindling days the cool-leaved holly keeps safe the memory of the sun. The dance goes on and is never ending. The circle turns and the singer sings. The year burns low, but the winter wood still holds the memory of the spring. The dance goes on and is never ending. The circle turns and the singer sings. The year burns low, but the winter wood still holds the memory of the spring. Still holds the memory of the spring. Still holds the memory of the spring.
That was the beautiful Four Seasons by Blanche Rowan and Mike Gulston from their new album, The Dance Goes On. You'll be hearing more from them in the future. And in the meantime, you can find more out about them in the show notes.
Absolutely lovely people.
They are.
Very talented as well.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of the show.
It does. And so before we go, we'd like to remind you to keep your eyes peeled for the second half of our interview with Grey Wolf, which will be appearing very soon.
We'd also like to wish you many blessings and say,
Hulvauer.
Day in a month.
Only if her name is Carol.
Not in the presence of a llama.
And only with a blindfold.
Is this llama the animal, or are we talking to Tibetan?
Either.
Okay, fair enough.
Yes, we have.
Can we do that again, darling?
Yeah, maybe.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Tell you what, I'll put the notes in the show. No, I'll put the show notes. No, I'll put the details in the show notes.
He's just doing it for extras now. He looks funny.
No, don't! It's not. That's completely false. Anyway, should we get back to the interview?
Probably a good idea, isn't it?
You've been listening to the Celtic Myth Pod Show. Available from CelticMythPodShow.com.
We hope you've enjoyed the show and will stay tuned for the next episode. You can send us an email or some voice feedback to Gary and Ruth at CelticMythPodShow.com. The show notes for this episode can also be found on the website. We'd like to say a special thank you to Coulan's Hounds, who provided us with the theme music for our show. Find them at www.sfhounds.com. We'd also like to say a big thank you to Anne Roos, Master Harper, and Keltoria, with a K, Celtic New Age Music, who have both given the show unrestricted access to their music. And thanks again go to Diane Arkinstone and Kim Robertson, whose music has been used as some of the transitions you've heard in this show. You'll find links to all of these wonderful artists in the show notes at shownotes.celticmythpodshow.com.